The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. And we have never done a program like this one because we're going to get into here in the era of big data, where data is supposed to direct all our decision making and it's supposed to be dispassionate, unbiased, and more insightful than the human mind. We're going to talk about intuitive investing, people who actually run you could say on their gut, but I think intuition sometimes goes beyond the stomach. Our guest is Deborah Diamond, and she is a former Wall Street money manager, a regular CNBC commentator, and Johns Hopkins University professor who left a high-profile life to pursue a life of purpose and spirituality. She is a best-selling author. She's a teacher, a speaker, an intuitive. In the institutional investment world, she was the first woman hedge fund manager, the first investor to create a deleveraged commodity fund, and a founder of the Women's Growth Capital Fund, the first venture fund to invest in women-led, women-owned companies. She is the author of Life After Near Death, Miraculous Stories of Healing and Transformation, and the Extraordinary Lives of People with Newfound Powers. Also, she has authored a book titled Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. She earned her MBA in finance from George Washington University. She's got a PhD from the Esoteric Interfaith Theological Seminary and is a graduate of the Jung Institute, as in Carl Jung, the great psychologist, my favorite psychologist of them all. She's also currently at work on a new book, and the title of that is what, Deborah?
I can't tell you the title yet, but the book is about intuitive investing.
So it's perfect for the subject. Yeah. So we welcome Deborah Diamond to the program. And Deborah, before I start asking you some questions, I want to give a quick little story about when I was a publisher of a newspaper with a different company. We had a networking event. So we put four different stations in the room, in this big ballroom, one of which was a caricature artist. Then we had a couple other things, and then we also had a psychic there. And lo and behold, there were people in line for all four of the stations, but the line for the psychic was a mile long. And I tell this story because this was a business group. This was a business environment. This was the professional set there in Portland. Now, I will also say that that line was 80 to 90% women rather than men. And why don't we start right there, Deborah? Because number one, there's clearly an interest in intuition and psychism and spirituality within the business community. Women tend to be much more open to that than men. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I'm glad to be here with you today. And, you know, in terms of intuition, the subject matter is one that's been increasing in interest for the last number of years. And it used to be primarily women who were interested, but I would say now, the queries that I get are probably split down the middle, 50-50 men and women. Now, I have to say that the people that contact me generally kind of look like me. They're professionals, they're educated, they're successful, in many cases, successful business people. So, you know, these are not people who are just, fell off the back of a truck and are looking for a fortune teller. These are sophisticated, educated people who believe that there's something else available. There's something else beyond just the rational mind.
And what are they coming to you for, Deborah?
They come for a variety of reasons, mostly life issues, and life issues include health, family, relationships, career. It could be life path, and they like to ask about investing, although I do not give investment advice. My investment advice is to invest in your own education in investing. But they, you know, they generally have, they're looking for options beyond what they've been able to find on their own. You know, we all have ideas about how we can solve various issues in our lives, but sometimes we don't see other options. So, you know, they're coming to me much like they would, I think, a therapist, but my source of information is different than a therapist. My source is pretty clear. I mean, intuition is a very soft, calm voice, but there's a lot of clarity. There's always clarity with intuition. It can be very accurate. It's what we embellish it with, or how we don't listen, or how we intellectualize it, or if we're not sure how to apply it. That's where we get lost. But, you know, in investing, since, you know, this is an investment program, I'm sure there are many in your audience who've said, you know, I knew I should have bought or sold that stock. That was your intuition talking to you, but you went somewhere else and you didn't listen to it. But intuition doesn't feel like the normal chatter in your brain, which is kind of a noisy chatter that goes on and on and on. Intuition is quiet and it's calm. And we use it in intuitive investing so that we can use our inner compass along with our rational mind to analyze an investment. And, you know, you don't have to choose between intellect and intuition. You use them both. You don't use one, you know, just one or the other. You use them both.
Would you say the intellect informs intuition? In other words, you take the data, you look, and you get familiar with the options, the data, the market, the dynamics at work, and that informs intuition?
It doesn't inform intuition. There are, you know, think of train tracks. They're on two parallel tracks. But, you know, you might be looking at a spreadsheet and you might sense a problem that exists when you look at that spreadsheet, even though the spreadsheet says otherwise. Or you might be able to forecast a trend at a company or an industry before anyone else can do that. And I mean, I think that's a process that's enhanced by having information flow in. But, you know, it's almost like your intuition is some sort of weighing machine that, you know, filter, you know, goes through all the information that we take in. And if it has a special message that it wants to send to us, you know, about that information, it does so. It's intuition is like a traffic light. So when it flashes green, you know, it's telling you to go. And when it flashes red, that means stop.
Talk about how you applied intuition when you were working on Wall Street. How did you, was it a conscious sort of thing, or did it just present itself? And when it presented itself, you paid attention. And when it didn't present itself, you just decided, well, you know, I go by the data. Was there any formal process to it for you?
I didn't know at the time that that's exactly what I was doing because, you know, as you can imagine, I worked with, you know, a lot of very left brain people. The idea of being intuitive or even being a psychic was not anything that ever came up in a conversation. And I wouldn't even have thought of it. I just knew that sometimes I would pick up an annual report or prospectus and I would just know without reading it that there was something there. I didn't know how I knew it, but I knew it. I knew it in my bones. And my boss used to say to me, you know, Deborah, you have really good instincts. And so I just decided, okay, that's the answer. I have good instincts. And I left it at that because I didn't have time or really any inclination to see if it was anything else. It never occurred to me it was anything else. So it was just part of the process. You know, I would do all the conventional work. I have an MBA. I do all the conventional work on a company. I'd analyze their balance sheet and their income statement. I'd interview the management. I'd, you know, look into the industry, the competitors, all of that. But there was always that X factor that you can't access through the linear mind that would say to me, this thing's going to go. This thing's going to go. And in fact, I'll tell you a little story. I mean, so many years ago, I went up to see a company in New York that was doing a roadshow at the 21 Club. I remember it was a lunch. And I was the only institutional investor there. Everyone else was a retail broker. You could tell because they all had their napkins wrapped around their necks. And not to disparage institutional brokers, but that was kind of the style. And so the the company was pioneering the mail order pharmacy business, and they had zero customers, no customers at all. And they were losing a lot of money. But I knew that there was something else there. So, you know, I went up for this meeting. I listened to the CEO and chairman who barely could, he barely could speak. And he didn't make that much sense. I understood what he was saying, but I don't think a lot of other people did. I listened to the CFO, who was more understandable. And, you know, I knew that I was going to recommend that we buy as much of this deal as we could, even though the numbers weren't exactly there. But I sensed when I listened to this chairman, this guy is going to create something important. And he had a track record, actually. He had a serial entrepreneur. He'd had several other companies that he created and sold at a big profit, usually to big companies like Johnson & Johnson. But he was not institutionally recognized on Wall Street. That didn't bother me because he was a winner. I came back to my company and they said, what did you think of this company? And I said, we have to buy, you know, I mean, I had done some work already, but, you know, we're going to have to buy this. And they said, why? I mean, the company has no sales, is, you know, losing a lot of money. And I said, it's going to be big. I just knew it. Well, we invested in that company and that turned out to be the single most successful investment in the history of this particular fund, which is a well-known fund on Wall Street. And, you know, I did the classical CFA kind of analysis on the company, although there wasn't lots you can do when a company is pioneering an industry. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was again about that X factor. And everybody has it. It's just that not everyone listens to it, you know, or they doubt it, you know, or they're looking for a different answer, or they're not accustomed to working with it. But this can be taught. Intuition can be taught. And it's really just a process of learning to accept and staying open. And, you know, it's exactly the opposite of the linear world, where the harder you work, the more successful you are. In the world of the spiritual or metaphysical, the more relaxed you are, the more successful you're going to be. So in other words, you can't sit there and say, oh, I'm trying so hard to be open. Well, that's not going to work.
That's a good point. People, happens with meditation all the time. I've read and a lot about meditation over the years and participated in it. And putting the effort in, I mean, it's sitting. The Zen masters will talk about just sitting rather than working at it. So were you then a meditator, or is there anything that you do to try to keep your intuition particularly heightened?
I'm not a meditator. I wasn't a meditator, and I'm still not a meditator. I am just able to access this information. It's always there. I keep it closed off because I don't really want to be walking around, you know, 24/7 having all sorts of stuff flying in. It's not really, you know, something I want to do. So I keep it closed unless I'm working or unless I need to know something. But for the most part, I keep it closed.
Was the company that you were just talking about, though, that was the most successful for that fund?
That was Medco Containment Services, which was bought by...
It begins the Sanford. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, it was an insurance company. Or not an insurance company. It was Merck.
A big drug.
Merck.
Oh, it was Merck. Okay, the pharma company. Okay.
It became Merck Medco.
Got it. So we're in the middle of a conversation here where I'm sure there's people who have rolled their eyes listening to some of what we're talking about, Deborah, because it is a very empirical business. Although I will say that I've seen a majority of people in a room when I ask them how many of you will admit that you make decisions based on emotion as much as anything, and the majority of the hands went up. Now, emotion and intuition are not necessarily the same thing, but obviously there's other factors than data that come into play. But at the same time, I think a lot of people think, oh, brother, intuition, psychism, I mean, what are you kidding me? What about that? Because there's a lot of, I would just say that there's a lot of misgivings about it or certainly cynicism about it?
I think it depends on who you're talking to. In fact, most of the very successful investors use some form of intuition. They may call it something else, but that's what they're doing. So if you, if you look at George Soros, who says, I rely on bodily hints and intuition for clues. He says, for instance, when he gets a backache after entering a trade, he takes that as a sign to close the position. That doesn't mean that if you're back.
Well, as he gets older, he's going to get more backaches too. He's going to be closing a lot of positions. I am being a little bit cynical.
Yeah, well, it's a signal that he knows and uses and recognizes, but each of us has our own signs and signals and feelings that we can utilize every day. Beyond that, there are many very successful institutional investors. Michael Steinhardt, who says that my instinct was very good. He'd say, no, that doesn't feel right. Adam Smith, who wrote The Money Game, said it's a kind of locked-in intuition, a feeling. The first thing you have to know is yourself. Leon Levy, when it comes to investing, intuition and analysis are inextricably bound together. Bernard Baruch, a skilled operator in any field, acquires an almost instinctive feel, which enables him to sense many things, even without being able to explain them. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but there are many, many, many very successful investors who are not just, doing this by looking at the same quantitative data that everyone else is looking at, which, by the way, a lot of those people are underperforming. So it doesn't work.
What about the new book you're working on? It's about intuitive investing, title to be determined, but that's the subject. What are some of the, if you don't mind doing this, if your publisher doesn't have a problem with you releasing some of the insights in it, what are a few of the bullet points that this book is going to deliver?
Well, I want it to be practical. So there are exercises in the book in terms of how to develop your intuition, firstly, and then after that, how to approach investing from an intuitive point of view. It was, specific exercises about that as well. You mentioned earlier, your emotions. Your emotions are very different than intuition. I mean, one emotion is fear, right? That's not an emotion that is very useful on Wall Street. Other emotions, there's certainly your ego, which is not an emotion, but it's a psychological issue. And that gets people into a lot of trouble. And they get investing or intuition confused with their ego. They hear a voice saying, you're going to make a lot of money on this. And they say, oh, that's my intuition. Well, generally, when it's something about you and you being important, that's not usually your intuition. That's usually your ego. Your ego wants to be recognized and wants to be important. So, there's a lot of things that you don't want to do thinking that they are intuition, because intuition is intuition.
What about the person? I mean, just to kind of put this in a little bit sharper perspective, what about the person who thinks they've got good intuition on these things and decides that's what I'm going to run on, period? I really am not going to look at anything other than names of companies, industries, think about maybe themes or what have you, but I'm not going to really delve into the data. Would you say that's not a good idea?
That is definitely not a good idea. As I said earlier, you want to do the work. You want to do the analytical, quantitative work. You want to look at the management. You want to look at the industry. You want to look at the numbers. Is the company, are their profit margins improving? Do they continue to have quarterly and annual earnings surprises? I mean, there's just so many factors to look at, but you have to look at them. And to just make decisions based on your intuition alone, it's not, you know, I don't think we can use intuition in our lives in many ways. And in many professions, people use intuition. Many. It's not just investing, but it's not meant to be just this seat of the pants thing that you are going to make your decisions by. You know, I read for a lady, she kind of looked like Joan Kennedy, you know, Teddy Kennedy's ex-wife. She was very patrician looking, and she showed up in a Chanel suit and pearls. She didn't look like the kind of person, you know, that you would expect to be having a psychic reading. But it turned out that she was the CEO of a company. And it was a very successful company. And she told me in the middle of our session that she made all her decisions for her company using her intuition. I mean, she understood the business part, but she always allowed her intuition to kick in. So that was her business was not in, she was not in the investment business. It was an operating business. So, you know, there are many people like that. I talked to somebody recently, very well-known, successful executive. And this person told me, you know, that they also use intuition when they make, you know, when they make decisions. So, you know, they're armed with all the analytical tools, but then they also are open and allow, you know, other messages to come in and accept them. So the trick is knowing what's your intuition and what isn't, you know. So that's, you know, that's another issue. But, you know, you asked about, or we talked earlier about emotions. I mean, emotional decision-making should not be playing a role. It's reactive, and it regulates things like fear and anger and judgment. And those are not the kinds of things that you want to be basing an investment decision on. And likewise, the feelings of happiness. That's not, you know, that you want to screen out all of those emotions and really just have access to your intuition. But I would not be making investment decisions or any decisions, you know, just based on solely on your intuition. You know, we have the ability to access a lot of information, so we should take advantage of that, right? Linear and nonlinear.
So, Deborah, you still live in the New York City area, or do you live somewhere else in the country?
No, I live in Maryland.
In Maryland, okay. What about, I actually want to jump back to what you were talking about earlier, developing intuition. And I remember I read a book years ago and I gave it away to somebody and I have never been able to find it since. The title was The Teachings of the Rosicrucians. And you probably know about the Rosicrucians and their spiritual order. And this book had short little chapters that would give you different exercises to do. And one of them was actually taking a box of toothpicks. This is going to sound strange, maybe. And you dump out the box of toothpicks and you pick them up one by one and you put them back into the box until you put them all back into the box in some semblance of order. Does that make any sense to you? I mean, it almost sounds like it's a way of focusing. It's almost like a moving meditation, it sounds like, but I'm not sure. And they had a whole host of other things in there. But what about that? Does that ring any bells with you?
Yeah, it does. So it is a form of meditation. You know, any kind of repetitive activity, it doesn't have to be just focusing on your breathing. It could be, you know, there are lots of different things that are repetitive. Ironing. I have people tell me ironing they find meditative. One of my sons tells me he likes to cut the grass. He just finds, you know, he walks back and forth, back and forth. He empties out his mind. He's just walking back and forth. That's a meditative activity. Walking itself is a meditative activity. So, you know, picking up these toothpicks one by one, you know, the same pattern, you know, over and over again, you know, you're just focusing on that. You're emptying out your mind. So it's a form of meditation.
You know, you mentioned walking. And that's certainly, for me, that's a form of meditation. I sometimes will go for walks with my wife and we do it for two different purposes. To me, the rhythm of the walking is what I lock into. So I want to keep that rhythm going. She looks at what the door is painted. She looks at architecture. She looks at landscaping and wants to stop me along the way and point things out And that's always a little frustrating because it's like you're breaking the rhythm. Let's just keep walking. It's like make your observations and then let me know at the end. But whether it's hiking or even just walking down a community street, I've always found that walking, in fact, I started carrying a recorder with me because it's during those walks that a lot of problem solving or ideas would come to mind. And I didn't want to have to try to hold those in my head till I got back and could actually write them down. I've always found walking to be a really, really a good meditative, especially for a person who, like myself, who has never been a real successful meditator in terms of sitting and meditation, because I've got very much the monkey mind they talk about. My mind jumps around a lot. But to be able to actually expel some energy at the same time. Although I find walking, it's not just using energy, it actually energizes me. And I'm sure that you've had the same experience of physical movement actually being additive, not subtractive to the energy bank. I'm kind of drifting right now, but there goes the monkey mind, right?
Well, you know, what you're referring to is, you know, walking and having these ideas pop into your head, you're allowing a space for them to surface. That's your intuition. You know, where do you think those ideas are coming from? You know, but you need a quiet space. You know, I remember talking to the son who told me that he liked to mow the grass because he thought it was meditative. He's a videographer for one of the major sports teams. And I think I was trying to solve an issue in one of my books. And I said to him, when you're, you know, editing something and you can't find that, you know, sort of thing that you need, what do you do? And he said, usually when I stop thinking about it, I find it. So, you know, it's the same. You went for a walk. You probably stopped thinking about it and, you know, you allowed, and that's when things start to flow. That's when they come in.
You know, Deborah, let's finish on the ultimate question, the ultimate it is the ultimate question. As I think Woody Allen said that in one of his movies, or one of his characters did. And it's a question that we don't talk about a lot. People tend to avoid, and that has to do with death or life after life. It's very confrontational. It's scary to a lot of people, even people who believe steadfastly in life after death, because you don't know exactly what that's like. The unknown is scary to people. So even if you believe, hey, there's a God and there's an entity and there's a universal mind and life goes on, it's a continuum, people are still intimidated by the thought of their mortal lives coming to the expiration point. You write about this, though. Talk a little bit about the thing that everybody is facing, which is the end of mortal life and hopefully what will become the entrance into immortality. What have you learned through your research that you would share with our listeners that, whether it's insightful or comforting or what have you?
Well, you know, in the Western world, we tend to think of life, we associate it with the physical body. You know, we see someone moving and breathing and talking, and we say they're alive. But when those functions cease to exist, then we say that they're dead. Well, the truth is there's more to life than just the physical body. You know, many years ago when my mother passed away, we had hospice come to the house. And at one point, one of the hospice professionals handed me a piece of paper, and I put it away. I thought maybe it had to do with medication or something. Eventually, I picked it up, and it said, when the body's ready and the soul isn't, we don't leave. When the soul is ready and the body isn't, we don't leave. When the body's ready and the soul is ready, then we leave. Well, that was a lot more than I expected from hospice, and you know, it was something I really had to think about. And I thought about it for many years. These people at hospice were not the first to think about this concept. I mean, this idea of body and soul has been around for thousands of years. You know, the ancient Greeks believed in it. I mean, the idea has been around as long as civilization has been around. But here in the Western world in particular, you know, we tend to think of life as, you know, just the physical body. But I believe that it's much more than that. And from so many people that I've talked to, I talk to people all over the world who tell me stories about things that have happened to them. And they know they can tell me because I'm safe. I've heard a lot of stories. But there are things that we can't explain about loved ones of ours who have passed, and maybe messages that we've gotten from them, or, you know, extraordinary events that we can't explain. But there's too many of them to say that it doesn't exist. And they're repetitive. I mean, somebody may have something happen to them, and then someone else around the world may have the same thing happen to them with their loved one. So, and they're not making this stuff up. So, you know, there's just more than what we can see. But unfortunately, because of Western medicine and Western science, we have sort of a limited concept, I believe, of what's, you know, what life is.
Well, and, you know, I think one of the most interesting things going on in that regard has to do with quantum mechanics and how physicists have realized that what we experience, what we consider reality, is very different than what's really there, that our senses don't so much open us up to the world as they actually screen out a lot of what is really there in reality, that there's much more going on than we're even capable of consuming or processing or fathoming. So it's science. And I remember sitting with a guy who said science is, and he was a scientist, says science and religion are in the same business. It's the explanation of reality. And they don't even know that. I mean, because they see themselves as inimical to one another, but in reality, there's a coming together there, especially with the insights of physics that we're seeing, very much consistent with a lot of the spiritual literature that's been written over the thousands of years from all different disciplines. So any final thoughts, Deborah, before we wrap it up?
No, I'm happy to be chatting with you today. I think it's an important topic. I think a lot of people are interested in it. I would just, again, advise people not to run off and start making investments based on what they think is their intuition. I don't think that's a good idea. If you want to try it, start with a paper portfolio and see how you do with that. Or start with some money that, you know, if you already have a traditional portfolio, or maybe you have a money manager managing your money and you have a little money on the side you want to play with, you know, you could try that. But please use both your intuition and your analytical abilities.
There you have it from our guest, Deborah Diamond, former Wall Street money manager, regular CNBC commentator, Johns Hopkins University professor. The list goes on from there. But she's also an author and writes about intuition, spirituality, and she's got a new book coming out about intuitive investing. Deborah, very, very interesting to be with you. Thank you for taking the time, and we'll look forward to your new book hitting newsstands.
Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed it.